Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
The 1980s was the apex of the teen movie craze. In 1985 saw the release of what has since become a minor cult classic in the genre, Tough Turf.
An outsider on the edge, caught between a dangerous loser.
Give him his bike back!
And a girl they both love.
She belongs to Nick.
Come on, Jimmy, Lincoln freed the slaves.
Tough Turf stars James Spader as a pensive high school student who pursues a disco dancer played by future Real Housewife Kim Richards, only to be terrorized by her psychotic ex-boyfriend, the leader of a gang of cartoonish street thugs. Car chases, death threats, and knife, gun, and even axe fights soon ensue. The movie is probably best known for the advice that Spader's father gives him midway through the movie.
Look, son, life isn't a problem to be solved, it's a mystery to be lived. So live it.
For the past 34 years, people reviewing the conviction of Fred Freeman have been living a similar mystery. In 1986, was Freeman an actual psychotic ex-boyfriend, a ninja with superpowers or at least super technology, and a member of a secret crime-fighting syndicate? Or was this a fictional persona created from movies by the video store clerk who dated him months before her new boyfriend turned up dead?
Welcome to Undisclosed, The State vs. Fred Freeman. This is the fourth episode in a four-episode series about Fred Freeman, who was convicted of the 1986 murder of community college student Scott Macklem. I'm Robbie Chaudhry, I'm an attorney and author of A Non-Story, and as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson, I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
In the past three episodes, we've noted several issues with the prosecution of Fred Freeman. Philip Joplin, the jailhouse informant who testified against him, subsequently recanted and claimed that he fabricated Freeman's confession in exchange for placement in a residential treatment program.
You were talking about Mr. Freeman. It says the dude was telling me, yeah, he did it, but you'd never be able to prove it. Did Mr. Freeman ever really say that?
No.
Did he ever say something about the victim screaming when he shot him?
No.
Did he ever say he used a shotgun to kill somebody?
No.
The state's two eyewitnesses were shown a photo array that a leading identification expert has said was the most suggestive she's ever seen. And the state's key eyewitness was subjected to what the leading expert has said is one of the worst examples of hypnosis he's ever seen.
Well, I mean, I've seen a lot of really bad examples of hypnotically refreshed memories, but this ranks close to the bottom, I would say. I mean, this really is an egregious example of how not to use hypnosis, right?
And Freeman's attorney, David Dean, was later disbarred for cocaine abuse, with witnesses saying he was abusing the drug at the time of Freeman's trial, and Freeman claiming that Dean prevented him from exercising his constitutional right to testify and calling his fiancée as a key alibi witness.
You could tell the guy was on something.
Mm-hmm.
He just was not... He couldn't really keep three thoughts in a row straight. He kept jumping all over the place, and he'd tell us one thing, and then he'd tell us another thing. It's like he had no idea what he was doing, it seemed like to me.
These issues would lead to a petition for a writ of habeas corpus that was filed with Judge Denise Page Hood in federal district court. And so, in 2010, Judge Hood had to balance the gravity of these errors against the weight of the evidence presented against Freeman at trial. With the eyewitness identifications tainted and its jailhouse informant recanting, that left the state with one key witness against Fred Freeman, Crystal Merrill, who was Frederick Freeman's ex-girlfriend and who was engaged to Scott Macklem at the time of his death. Here's John Mayer, one of Freeman's previous appellate attorneys.
The lead witness put on by the prosecution was a young lady who was a fiance of the young man that was shot and killed. And she testified, she was on the stand for a couple of days.
So, to make sense of Merrill's testimony, let's start by going back to the timeline. On April 17, 1986, Karen Scheman rented her house out in Port Huron to Fred Freeman, who at the time was going by the name John Lamar, and also to his pregnant fiance, Michelle Woodworth. Before moving on, though, let's sort out two details. First, there's Freeman's use of the alias John Lamar.
So, because I had a warrant from Washington State, which was just for a probation violation on the bad check charge, I didn't want to have to go back to Washington State, and if I'd gotten stopped, I knew I would get sent back to Washington. And so I had a friend of mine named John, and all I did was just use his name. I didn't have any John ID, so that's why when they arrested me, I didn't have a bunch of fake ID or anything. I hadn't gone down and gotten like a John Lamar driver's license or anything. I knew his birth date, and I knew his full name, and he had a unique spelling with the J-O-N. And in those days, of course, also, you know, computer technology was very different. So if you get pulled over and you didn't have your license, unless you were a real jerk to the cop, you just gave him your name, and they'd say, you know, make sure you have your license with you the next time, and they would check you out. They didn't get back a big picture of you or anything. So you say your name is John Lamar and your birthday's, you know, 32162, and they'd run back and they check that, and it comes out okay. And if they weren't really sure, they might ask you your address. And that was really about how simple it was at that time. So it wasn't, some big process where I went out and like, you know, fake licenses and passports or anything like that.
And second, there's the nature of his relationship with his fiancée.
And so I'm sure we're going to get questions from our listeners. So in terms of your relationship with Shelley, is that just... Is it an open relationship? Is it just you're cheating on her and she doesn't know? Or what's the nature of your...
No. She'll tell you. She absolutely knew I was going on. I never lied to her. There's no way to justify it. I was young and I was like a lot of guys back then. Trying to be cool, and you know, the whole thing that was pressed on us was, you know, you have to have as many girlfriends as possible to show that you're cool and you're hip or whatever. So for me, it was, you know, the rock and roll, the leather jacket, and the motorcycle, and the girlfriends, and you know, I could sing pretty well. I'm sure she'll tell you that, and you know, the martial arts, all the things that made you cool back then, I was doing.
And so, with that background, a couple of weeks after moving into Scheman's house, Freeman and Woodworth went to a video store at Pine Grove Mall in early May to rent a horror movie that had recently hit VHS.
Ghoulies. They'll get you in the end.
But there was another movie with a similar name that had also recently hit VHS.
Besides, we gotta get to the police.
Maybe Chunk already got to the police.
Maybe Chunk is dead.
Don't say that. Never say that. Goonies never say die.
And so, when Freeman asked the video store clerk, 20-year-old Crystal Merrill, to rent Ghoulies, it set up another 1980s trope, the meet cute.
She gave me the wrong video. When I met her, I went to the video store, I ordered Ghoulies, and she gave us Goonies, the comedy. And when I took it back, she was like, oh, I'm so sorry. Let me take you out to dinner and I'll make it up to you. And I was like, okay, whatever.
But while this might have been a meet cute, the rest of the relationship was anything but, with each side pointing the finger at the other. But both Freeman and Merrill agreed that their fling was fleeting. It lasted about 6 weeks, until late June or early July. And they both agreed that after they stopped seeing each other, they really stopped seeing each other. Merrill would testify at Freeman's preliminary hearing that after they broke up, he called two or three times in late June or early July, but that her mom wouldn't let her talk to him. And that was it. No more talking or seeing each other until after the murder. and as Karen Sheeman and Fred Freeman both confirm, Freeman stopped running Sheeman's house around Labor Day and moved to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan about 2 months before the murder. So how did Freeman become a suspect in the November 5th murder of Scott Macklem back down in Port Huron? According to Crystal Merrill's testimony, she was working at State Farm in the morning of the murder when she received back-to-back calls from police officers about Scott being shot. Crystal would testify that the second officer asked her if she had any former boyfriends, and she named John Lamar.
Subsequently at the hospital, officers spoke with Crystal and her 15-year-old sister, Tracy, who provided further information about Lamar. Let's start with Tracy. Officer Carmody's police report states that Tracy told him two things. First, that Crystal had said a man named Arnell Hope had been beat up by this John Lamar at one time because he had dated Tracy's sister. She states that this subject has had other contacts with the John Lamar subject and may be able to provide additional information. In January 1987, another officer would follow up on this lead by speaking with Fred Macklem, the father of Scott Macklem, and he sung a similar tune. According to Fred, Arnell Hope had a previous encounter with John Lamar, aka Fred Freeman, and two other individuals who were on his case about going out with Crystal. Words soon turned to blows, with Lamar laughing throughout the encounter. This, of course, would be compelling evidence that Freeman could have similarly terrorized Scott Macklem, except officers then tracked down Arnell Hope a couple of weeks later. Hope confirmed that he had casually dated Crystal Merrill a few times in April 1986 before going down to Mississippi in the first week of May to, like Mark Twain, work on a boat on the river. And Hope also confirmed that he was jumped by three men at a Taco Bell upon returning to Port Huron in June. But according to Hope, presumably after being shown photos, quote, he had never knowingly met this Lamar and had never seen the subjects that were in the Taco Bell lot before. At Fred Freeman's preliminary hearing, his attorney, David Dean, pressed Crystal on the contradiction, asking her whether Arnell Hope ever said that Freeman, aka Lamar, attacked him, and she had to answer, quote, I don't think Arnell had ever seen him. In turn, Dean followed up with a version of the classic, is he lying to you or were you lying question. But at trial, while Arnell Hope was mentioned as the man Crystal dated before Freeman, Dean never mentioned the apparently made-up allegation that Freeman had attacked him.
This then takes us to the second thing that Tracy told Officer Carmody on the morning of the murder. According to Tracy, there was an incident on Father's Day, June 15, 1986, when she got worried about her sister because she hadn't come home to milk the cows on the family farm. And so she went to John Lamar's house with her boyfriend. Tracy said that she went to the front door and spoke with Lamar, with Crystal hearing her and coming to the front door as well. Tracy would testify at trial that she just got the feeling that Lamar didn't want her to talk to her sister, but that he did let Crystal leave. And then, as Crystal was leaving, Tracy testified that Lamar ran back in the house and grabbed something, with Crystal doubling back to the house, pushing Lamar, and then leaving. Now, Crystal wouldn't mention this incident in her statements to the police on the day of the murder or the next day, but it would become a big part of her testimony at trial. According to Crystal, the thing that Lamar, aka Fred Freeman, had grabbed was a long gun, and she pushed him because she was staring down the barrel of that gun. Crystal admitted that she couldn't distinguish between a shotgun and a .22 rifle, which is notable because A, Scott Macklem was killed with a 12-gauge shotgun, and B, Freeman was known to possess a .22 rifle but has never been connected to a shotgun. But nonetheless, you can imagine how the jury would have found this testimony by Crystal compelling. But as with Arnell Hope, there's a problem here, albeit a different one. No one ever contacted Tracy's boyfriend, whom both Merrill said was there for this incident, and his name isn't even on the record. Colin knows this because Fred Freeman's private investigator, Herb Welser, was recently able to track him down, and his name is Jim Ebner. He confirmed to Colin that no one had ever spoken to him about the incident. He also said the following.
Right, but basically Tracy went up to get her sister at the house.
Yes.
And then Crystal did eventually leave?
Yes.
And do you remember any type of physical altercation?
No, I don't remember none of that.
Do you remember a weapon or some type of gun being drawn?
I heard there was a weapon drawn, but I can't say for 100% sure on that.
Okay. You heard it, but you didn't actually see anything yourself?
No.
Okay. And that's pretty much all you remember, is that you went to the house to get Crystal. She left, and you didn't see anything in the way of a physical altercation or a weapon?
No, I didn't see that.
And so, both of the leads that Tracy Merrill gave to Officer Carmody on the day of the murder to put him on the trail of Fred Freeman now seem to be dead ends. Arnell Hope denies being attacked by Freeman or even meeting him, and Jim Ebner has no recollection of Freeman pulling a gun on Crystal or things even getting physical. This then takes us to what Crystal told Sergeant Bounds on the day of the murder. According to Crystal, John Lamar was, quote, real heavy into ninja and martial arts. The next day, she would add that he, quote, also wears poison darts taped around his wrists and his high tennis shoes. He has a pocket in the tongue of them where he keeps some type of weapon. Chris would later indicate that Lamar slash Freeman had all sorts of martial arts weapons, leading to lengthy testimony by her and his karate alibi witnesses at trial about weapons such as scythes, swords, quarterstaffs, and nunchucks. Given that this weaponry is more suited to Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles than a simple shotgun murder, you might have expected objections by defense counsel. But none came. Instead, Prosecutor Bob Cleland was given free rein to distract the jury with evidence as irrelevant as it was prejudicial.
The prosecutor put out massive displays of weaponry, none of which were mine, you know, but gave the illusion that they were mine. There were electronic listening devices, he had a parabolic microphone, ninja magazines, there were swords, knives. These were all on the prosecution's table sitting in front of the jury during the course of the trial.
That said, in her first police statement, Crystal did make a more serious allegation. Quote, she stated that at one time, Lamar beat her up just to see what her reaction would be and to see how she would defend herself. Now, it's important to take any allegation of interpersonal violence seriously, but it's also important to note that there's no corroboration for this claim. Crystal's sister Tracy would testify at trial that Crystal never told her that Lamar attacked her. While Crystal testified to Tracy having bruises at one point during the relationship, she said that Crystal claimed they were the result of a fight with a female acquaintance. Tracy also testified that Crystal didn't tell her about another claim that Crystal made at trial. Here's Thomas Brennan, the former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Michigan.
She claims he raped her, although she didn't tell her parents. And the day after the so-called rape, he comes back into the store where he met her and asks to borrow her car, which she gives him.
Now, to be clear, the fact that Crystal never told her sister or parents that she was raped by Freeman on their first date does not refute her claim. Nor does the fact that she loaned her car to him the next day or continued to see him for 6 weeks. And Crystal claims that the car borrowing and continued relationship with Freeman were because she was afraid of him. But the reasons she gives for that fear are pretty out there.
According to Crystal, there was a time when Freeman got in a knife fight with another guy. And then there's a time they got into a high-speed car chase. As Freeman listened to her testimony at trial, it rang a bell.
I thought it was the most ridiculous testimony I ever heard in my life. It was like something out of a bad movie.
And that bad movie was one he had watched while he was with Crystal. It was, you guessed it, Tough Turf. During cross-examination at trial, Freeman would consult with his attorney, who then asked the following question. Crystal, isn't it a fact that you've taken most of this testimony from a movie that you saw with the defendant called Tough Turf? And while Crystal denied it, the parallels between the movie's psychotic ex-boyfriend and her claims about Freeman are uncanny. These include the movie villain committing sexual assault in the same manner described by Merrill.
Okay.
Not now.
What are you doing?
To the high-speed car chase. To the knife fight. To the movie villain and his thugs threatening and attacking his ex-girlfriend's new suitor.
If I ever catch you near Frankie again, I'll take you out so fast you won't even have time to spit.
Now, at this point you might be thinking, okay, there are some striking similarities. But yes, psychotic boyfriends and ex-boyfriends exist, and Fred Freeman might have been one of them. But the group that Merrill said Freeman led was not your average street gang. It was called the Yakuza. and she would testify that this was what led him to attack her and see if she could defend herself. As she would testify at trial,
"Yes, he explained all about the ninja, where they originated from, how the Akuzar, the group that he belonged to, was against prostitution and everything. He said it's a good organization. He said, see, you could be a part of that. You could fight the criminals out there and everything. And he said, we also fight against this other Japanese organization that is for prostitution, that is for drugs. We're against that, he says. And you can make so much out of yourself just as long as you had to learn how to fight. You had to learn how to meditate. You had to learn all these things that they had known how to do."
Now, for reference, the Yakuza is essentially the Japanese mafia, with any activity in the United States basically limited to Hawaii. So where might Meryl have gotten her claims about Freeman using poison darts and ninja stars and being involved in ninja warfare right here in the US of A? Well, that takes us to another movie Meryl and Freeman watched together, Revenge of the Ninja.
When he came to America, he put aside his weapons.
"I will not follow the way of the ninja."
But he could not put aside his destiny as a warrior.
And so, again at trial, defense counsel would ask Crystal whether she was making up claims about Freeman based upon what she had seen in a movie. And, as noted in episode 1, this also led to the sidetracking of alibi testimony by the head of the karate studio in Escanaba.
"They were getting everything that they... All their questions came from three movies by Sho Kasugi, and it was Enter the Ninja, Ninja 3, The Domination, and Revenge of the Ninja. And everything they were asking about came from those particular three movies. And it was pure BS."
Crystal Merrill would also go on to explain that while Freeman was a member of the good group that would fight this bad group, everything had to be kept in the down low. She would eventually testify,
"He had a girlfriend, and he was telling me how he had told her not to say anything to anybody about where he came from, what he did, or the organization, or anything like that. And he said what happened to her could happen to you. And I asked him, what happened to her? And he said, well, because she started telling too much, I sent friends to go and break both her legs."
She then added,
"He just said girlfriends went to break her legs because she told so much about this organization that he had."
Now at this point you might be thinking, clearly this leg breaking never happened. But you can at least imagine Freeman posturing, and the prosecution presenting Merrill's testimony to show he was intimidating her with false claims so she wouldn't reveal the reality of the relationship. But no, the prosecution presented Merrill's testimony as true. Here's Elwood Brown, one of the prosecutors in the Freeman case.
"Fred Freeman was able to collect what we refer to in loose terms as a harem. He had a bunch of women that would do almost anything for him."
This theory did two things for the prosecution. First, Freeman having this harem of helpers supported their chartered plane theory of the murder, which would have required at least two accomplices. And second, it flowed right into their theory of motive for Freeman killing Scott Macklem. Let's start by breaking down Meryl's relationship with Macklem. They had previously dated, but they broke up before she dated Arnell Hope and then Fred Freeman. And then, after Meryl and Freeman broke up, she got back together with Macklem. So, did Freeman ever meet Macklem before heading to the Upper Peninsula? Freeman says no.
"As far as I know, I've never met Scott Macklem."
Meanwhile, Meryl says that Macklem and Freeman saw each other once, but didn't talk. Macklem had come to see her at work, and the two talked in the parking lot while Freeman glared at them from inside the video store, but never approached them. Here's Freeman's take on the story.
"Even if you believe Crystal's story, she said supposedly we saw each other for 3 seconds across a parking lot and glared. Not we met and we confront each other and saw each other's face or anything like that. That's just her story. That supposedly I'm looking out like a video store window and he's across a parking lot or some garbage like that. And of course she made that up later. She made that up months later. But even she doesn't place me in any situation where I could know Scott, know what he looks like, know what he's driving, any of that stuff. So there's no way the police didn't know early on that Scott's killer knew him and knew everything about him. Meanwhile, I'm living out in the woods in a farmhouse in Rock, Michigan. you know, with no way to gather all this intelligence and all this data that I would have gathered for months, you know, to plan this ridiculous crime.
So, two takeaways here. First, how does Fred Freeman form a blood feud against Scott Macklem when this was their only contact? And second, in the pre-internet era of 1986, how does Freeman know enough about Macklem to commit this meticulous murder laid out by the state?
So, more importantly, we know he's going to college now. He obviously wasn't going to college when he was seeing Crystal when I was down here. So again, no way I could know this guy's in college. I know nothing about him. Crystal never claimed she gave me any of his information whatsoever. I had no means to get that kind of information. And besides that, he wasn't in college or working at that store when the murder, when I was seeing Crystal. Whoever killed him that morning, and like I said, it was about 20 below that day if you check the weather. Whoever killed him was waiting for him and knew he was going to be in that parking lot and knew when he was going to be in that parking lot. And as you know, he was killed skipping class. So I don't think somebody was sitting in the lot waiting for him to be through all six or seven of his classes that day at sub-zero temperatures. This person knew Scott was not going to be in class, knew he was going to be at that college on that day at that time, knew what he looked like, was able to easily and quickly identify him among a bunch of other young college kids, and apparently at some point pursued him.
So how did the state overcome this obvious gap in its case? Well, remember how Freeman previously described the prosecutor laying out for the jury an assortment of martial arts weapons and listening devices, none of which actually belonged to him? The listening devices were displayed because Mero claimed that, as part of his Yakuza, Freeman had access to listening devices and had claimed to have bugged her phone, house, and car. Now, notably, no bugs were ever found, and as noted, neither were any listening devices. But Merrill would testify that, after her parking lot conversation with Macklem, she came upon Freeman with what looked like a small Walkman with earphones that he claimed was a listening device. And she claimed that Freeman was able to recount the key part of their conversation, which consisted of Macklem calling Freeman a jerk. Now, it's unclear why Macklem would be saying this because everyone agrees that he had previously never met Freeman. But you know what? It's a line of dialogue from the movie Tough Turf.
This makes me a little crazy. I mean, what do you think I felt knowing I was this jerk off?
And the state's theory was that this comment also made Freeman crazy and obsessed with Macklem, although no witnesses testified at trial that Macklem ever said that Freeman had threatened him. But Mero claimed that Freeman had threatened him, saying that he was going to call his associates in the Yakuza to put a hit out on Scott. From all this, we can now fast forward to November 13th, 1986. Freeman had learned that Merrill had accused him of Macklem's murder, so he entered a donut shop to call her and clear things up.
I wound up at a donut shop. I believe it was a Winchell's, maybe. And I'm in this donut shop, and I go to the payphone in the donut shop. We didn't have, like, the phone cards and stuff you have nowadays, but you had, like, a phone card that had a number, like a code number, and you could bill stuff to your home phone. And so, billing a call to my home phone, I call Crystal, and we start talking, and I'm like, why are you telling the police that I killed your boyfriend? And she's saying all this crazy stuff. And so I know people are listening. She's going like, remember that one time you had those poison darts? And I was like, what are you talking about, you whack job? So the cool thing is, in the notes from Dave Hall, who was allegedly listening to this call, he tries to testify at trial that I had said all this stuff, and he said he took it all from his notes. Well, we had a fight, but we got his notes, and you should have those now. They're attached to habeas. And in the notes, you'll see not a single thing he said that I said is in those notes. It's me accusing her of stuff. So there's a note like, get me some coffee. Then there's one like, he just called her crazy. And then it's, do we know where he's at? And then it will be like, he just said to her, according to you, I'm driving around shooting people. Well, then he would say things on the stand like, what did he say? Oh, he said he was driving around shooting people. The notes actually say that that I said to her, according to you, I've been driving around shooting people. Because the cop had told me that. He also told me about the parking lot, too, when I asked him where this is supposed to have happened. And I literally had no idea where this college was at. We never went into that town for anything. And there's a little mall by the expressway. That was as far as Shelly and I ever went. So I'm accusing her of, making up this phony story. I'm like, you were crazy then. You're crazy now. You're a nut. And she's trying to keep me on the phone, and I know that. And I'm like, look, I know you're trying to keep me on the phone, okay? Listen, why do you think that I did this? I dumped you. I never saw you again. I couldn't stand you. I told you I didn't want you around my home. Why would I do this? And she'd be like, oh, how have you been? I've missed you. It was so pathetic. So I'm getting ready to hang up. Next thing you know, two cops come in. They got body armor on from the neck, like, down to the knees. And I see them. And so I hang the phone up, and I walk up to them, and they're terrified because they had told them all these stories about me. I'm this little punk 23-year-old kid, you know. And they told me I had all these crazy weapons on me, and that I was gonna go down fighting and all this. And of course, you know, I had never said anything like that, or I don't have a history like that. And so, long story short, I can see they're freaking out. I'm like, guys, relax. I don't know what's going on, but I haven't done anything wrong. And they're like, you're supposed to be some kind of a badass, and you're gonna break all these weapons out. I said, I am not armed. And they're like, well, can we search you? And so they got the radio, and there was SWAT out there. And, you know, SWAT was different in those days, Kyle. You know, nowadays you get, like, boots on the neck, and they come screaming in. They got the steel face mask and all that. This was the 80s. This was back when they still wore baseball caps. And they didn't, you know, they didn't jump on you unless you were fighting back. So they were really cool. And they said, listen, we need to cuff you. I said, that's okay, no problem. And they cuffed me, and he gets on the radio and goes, he's complying, he's not armed. And then the other guy goes, what happened to all the poison darts and the steel blades he's supposed to pull out on us? And I hear that, and I start laughing. I'm like, what? He's like, oh, yeah, they told us all this BS about you, and you had guns, and you're going to do all this stuff. And I was like, what? So they asked me if they could search my vehicle. And I said, look, I don't know what's going on, but I feel like I'm being set up here. I said, can I watch? And they took me out to my car in the parking lot. They let me watch while they searched the vehicle. I didn't have any of that stuff, of course. And they took my keys, put in the glove box, and they locked up the car.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Super Sale and get 40% off paints and stains September 19th through the 24th. With prices starting at $29.39, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
So let's look at this from two angles. First, no shotguns, shotgun shells, or listening devices were found in Freeman's car or Freeman's place in Rock, Michigan. Notably, however, both a shotgun shell box and a shotgun shell were recovered near the scene of the murder. The box was an empty 20-gauge shotgun shell box with a latent fingerprint that was not a match for Fred Freeman. And while Scott Mathlin was killed with a 12-gauge shotgun shell, a witness would testify at trial that the same shotgun could shoot both a 20-gauge shell and a 12-gauge shell. Meanwhile, the shotgun shell was recovered about 60 feet northwest of Macklem's body, and it was a 12-gauge shell. And yet, that shell was never tested for fingerprints. Why? Sergeant Bounds would testify the shell didn't have chamber markings consistent with being chambered or fired, so he didn't send it for fingerprinting. Which seems like an odd decision. Sure, this seems to make clear this wasn't the shell that killed Macklem, but couldn't it easily have been a shell the killer accidentally dropped in haste while trying to load his shotgun or flee from the murder scene? In any event, returning to Freeman's car, there was one piece of evidence recovered from the trunk that could have connected him to the murder scene, a green army jacket. Recall the eyewitness Rennie Gobin said the man you saw driving away from the murderer was wearing an army jacket, and the eyewitness Richard Krueger initially said something similar before later clarifying the man he saw was wearing a green jacket that was more like a winter coat than an army jacket. For his part, Freeman says the jacket found in the trunk wasn't even his and was left there by his friend Mickey Forder's brother Tom.
So when I was in the service, and I have photos of me in the Army if you need pictures, we wore camouflage fatigues. That's an old Vietnam-era green jacket. That's not my jacket. Mickey got that at some used clothing store or something, and Tom used to wear it. And it's got some little pins on it. You'll see Cleland talking about pins. There's a little, like a little Germany pin, and I don't know what the other one is that's on there, because I know Cleland's mentioning the pins at trial, but that wasn't my jacket. And again, that was part of the same game. Richard Krueger's testimony, his initial testimony, preliminary, he went on and on about how it was not a green Army field jacket. He explained how he was in the Navy, and it was like a puffy green ski coat that he saw, not a guy wearing a green field jacket. What they tried to do later on is say, oh, well, he had a green field jacket in his car. Okay, now it's a green field jacket. So I never wore a field jacket then. Nobody up there saw me wearing that. I don't think I'm able to say they did. I never did. Shelley will tell you I didn't. I wore denim jackets, leather jackets, and I had a black wool duster. And I was wearing the great big black wool duster the day that I saw everybody in town. It was like, you know, 20 below that day, and the wind was whipping. And so that was in the trunk of the car, but it wasn't my coat. I never wore the coat.
Now, unfortunately, we don't know where that jacket is today, but there are reasons to believe that Freeman wouldn't have worn it. And in terms of breaking that down, just this might not be something I can rule out or not, but size-wise, are you bigger, smaller than Mickey in terms of the fit of the jacket, just sake of argument?
No, Mickey's a lot bigger than me.
Okay.
He's a big guy.
Like, yeah. So how big are you?
I weigh like 100 and around 170 pounds back then. Mickey was like, you know, 260, 270. He was a big guy. He had a big gut on him. He was a heavy, heavy guy.
And so do you know the size of that jacket, how big it was?
No, I don't.
But in other words, probably if you were to put this on, it would be sort of swallowing you and you would look, you know, like you're wearing your parents' jacket, basically.
Well, I'm a lot bigger now. I mean, I weigh like 220 pounds.
But at the time, it would have looked ridiculous, basically.
Oh, it would have been like a dress on me. Yeah, I would look like an idiot in it, yeah. I was an 80s guy, you know. I wore everything ass tight. You know, back then, our jeans were like, you couldn't even move in them. You know, my leather jackets were all like the short kind, you know, that like went to the waist.
Uh-huh.
All my t-shirts, including the one I was wearing when I was arrested, was like at the waist. That's how we wore everything back then, really, really tight. I would never have worn like a great big, you know, floppy, non-fitting jacket. But I never wore those jackets anyways. They're kind of cliche. The stoners wore those back in the 70s and 80s. You know, the drug guys wore those.
Yeah.
So that just wasn't my thing, you know.
And of course, you might be wondering whether the jacket was tested for gunshot residue, given that there certainly would have been some type of residue on the sleeve if it were worn by the shooter. Private investigator Herb Welser asked Detective Hudson, one of the detectives in the case, about this and reported the following. I asked Detective Hudson about the green army jacket that was taken out of the trunk of the vehicle and confiscated as evidence. I pointed out to Detective Hudson that he had noted in his report that he was going to submit this coat to the crime lab for a nitrate test, and I asked him if that was ever done. He stated that he could not remember if it was done, and if it was not done, he does not know why it was not done. And so we're left with a question mark, rather than an answer, to the question of whether Fred Freeman wore the jacket and shot Scott Macklin, or whether it was in fact a jacket belonging to Mickey Ford.
Now, Mickey Ford also plays into the second key aspect of Freeman's call with Merrill, which is his claim that he had dumped Merrill and she started harassing and making up crazy stories about him, because he wouldn't get back together with her. You might recall from episode 1 that when Freeman moved to the Upper Peninsula, he changed his alias from John Lamar to Mickey Ford. And according to Freeman, the reason for this change was Merrill.
So when we went up north, I said, well, you know, Crystal was nuts and she'd been stalking me, and I didn't want to use that name anymore because I figured she would try to do something with that or try to track me down. And so I talked to Tom, and Tom had a brother named Mickey. And so I just became Mickey. I had the nickname anyways as a kid for my grandmother.
Freeman's fiance, Michelle Woodworth, corroborates his claim.
And then ultimately they have this theory that they say that he had this breakup with Crystal Merrill and he was obsessed with her. And my understanding from you is that you have a very different take on the end of their relationship, right?
Yes, we lived in Port Huron in the summer, and he had brought her over. She was very happy, very excited to be with him. He said that he was going out, I don't know, to dinner, movie, whatever, that they were going out together. So they were very happy. I mean, she seemed very happy. Then all of a sudden, she was like constantly, she was coming over in the morning, banging on the door, wanting to talk to him. She was acting very mad, you know, very angry with him, demanding to see him. And finally, it was not long where he just said, you know, we need to go, because she was just really, it wasn't so happy anymore. She was really angry.
Right. And so your understanding in your time with Fred leading up to November 5th, he's not really that concerned with her or holding any sort of feelings about her?
No, not at all. No, he just wanted to get away from her.
Right.
That was in the summertime. Yeah, he just said, we're just going to move away. I don't, you know, I don't want anything to do with this girl. He kept telling her he wanted her to leave when she would come over and demand to see him, you know. And he just said, tell her, get out of here. I don't want to talk to her. I don't have anything to do with her.
This then takes us back to Judge Hood's decision in Fred Freeman's habeas petition in 2010. She found four things. First, that trial counsel was ineffective in failing to call Woodworth, both because she could have contradicted the state's narrative and provided an alibi for Freeman in Rock, Michigan, at the exact time that Scott Macklin was shot down in Port Huron. Second, trial counsel violated Freeman's right to testify by refusing to allow him to take the stand. Third, the recantation by jailhouse informant Philip Joplin undermined any confidence in the jury's verdict. And fourth, that the suggestive photo array shown the state's eyewitnesses further undermined that confidence. In granting Freeman a new trial, Judge Hood held that, quote, it's inconceivable that a rational jury that's faced with the evidence that's been developed since trial and should have been presented at trial could possibly find that Frederick Freeman had anything to do with this. But 2 years later, this grant of freedom was revoked. In 2012, the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit reversed Judge Hood. In terms of not calling Woodworth, the court held that trial counsel believed that, quote, Freeman's alibi would be persuasively established by other disinterested witnesses, one of whom was particularly excellent, rendering Woodworth's potential testimony cumulative. With regard to Freeman's claim that his attorney prevented him from testifying, the court refused to believe what it called Freeman's self-serving affidavit, instead relying on the word of his attorney, who'd been disbarred for cocaine abuse and stealing from his clients. As for Joplin, he signed his first affidavit stating that his testimony against Freeman was incentivized, but he died before he could sign a second affidavit, fully recanting and admitting that Freeman never confessed to him. And so, even though he was filmed offering a full recantation, the court found that the lack of a second signed affidavit meant that the evidence was not sufficient to require a new trial. Finally, the photo array. While the court acknowledged it was suggestive, it also pointed out that some of the ways it was suggestive could have hurt Freeman at trial. For instance, Freeman's police placard was from a different police department than the placards on the other people in the photo array. And the court observed that this different placard could have revealed that Freeman had a previous arrest by another police department, causing prejudice.
It all seems pretty ticky-tack and, for Freeman, devastating, but it was enough for the court to deny relief, despite recognizing Freeman's, quote, particularly excellent alibi. Freeman has had subsequent appeals, including a recent one that was heard by a federal judge in Kentucky, because the lead prosecutor from his trial is now a federal judge in Michigan. And so the entire federal bench in Michigan recused itself. Freeman's latest appeal was rejected less than a year ago, on May 17, 2019. But around the same time, he got a possible lifeline. Last year, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel announced the formation of a statewide conviction integrity unit. And as its head, she appointed Robin Frankel, a longtime criminal defense attorney very much in the mold of Patricia Cummings, the head of the Philadelphia CIU.
Probably a little over a year ago, I got a phone call. We had a new attorney general was elected, and she wanted to start a conviction integrity unit, had been interviewing, and hadn't found exactly what she was looking for. And a friend of mine at the office called and said, hey, the AG's looking to fill this position. I want to give her your name. Would you be interested? And I hadn't even thought about it. I didn't know she was setting up an office. And I was, you know, just perfectly happy going along in my little private practice. But when the phone call came, it really gave me, I mean, it made me stop. You know, I stopped and thought about what I was doing and where I was heading. And I have a friend who was running the Conviction Integrity Unit in Wayne County, which is Detroit, which is the biggest county in Michigan. And I had spoken with her maybe 2 or 3 days before I got this phone call about how I thought she just had the perfect job. She was doing the same kind of work she and I had always done, which was trying to ensure justice and fairness, and trying to give opportunity and voice to folks in the system who previously had none, trying to keep the system honest. And she was doing it with the ability, with the government behind her, right? So as a private practitioner trying to fight those battles without access to files or the law enforcement agencies, you're always up against a brick wall. And here I was being given an opportunity to try and pursue the same kind of work I've been trying to do my whole life, but having a support system built in place. Mm-hmm. So I said, yeah, I'm interested.
And according to Frankel, the model for the statewide CIU is the successful version that already exists in Wayne County, covering Detroit.
We could see from the outside what was happening in Wayne County. I mean, Wayne County, I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of speaking with Val Newman, who's quite amazing. Val started the Conviction Integrity Unit in the Wayne County office 2 years ago, and they've already exonerated 15 people. Well, they've vacated convictions. They're not all exonerations, right, but they have vacated convictions in 15 cases. And so those of us elsewhere in the state are looking at that saying, if this is happening in one county in the state, we have to provide something similar for the rest of the state. And we have 83 counties in Michigan. I can't really give you percentages for what I'm about to say, but I think it's fair to say that the vast majority of those counties are very small and rural, including the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And so if you want to run a best practices conviction integrity unit, offices with, you know, two prosecutors or half a dozen prosecutors don't have the capacity to have an independent unit. And so what our hope is that we'll be a resource for the rest of the state.
And indeed, despite being in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, one of Fred Freeman's friends, Kevin Harrington, had his conviction reversed after Kim Worthy and her office uncovered evidence of police misconduct. Fred Freeman won't be so lucky. While Freeman was one of the first to file with the new statewide CIU, Frankel told Colin that things were just getting started up when the pandemic hit, and so any relief in his or other cases might take a while. So, in addition to the evidence of Fred Freeman's innocence, is there evidence of an alternate suspect who could have committed the murder? And the answer is yes, there is. There are actually a few of them, but we've honed in on one in particular. It all starts with an anonymous phone call to the police on the afternoon of November 13th, 1986. According to the caller, at 1:45 p.m., he saw the person the police were looking for in connection with the Macklem murder driving in a red Ford Escort toward Port Huron. According to the anonymous caller, he knows the driver and knows Scott Macklem's parents very well. The police ran the plates on the Ford Escort, and it was owned by a woman unconnected to Fred Freeman. And in any event, Freeman had been arrested earlier in the day on the Upper Peninsula, so clearly he wasn't the driver. And so the police disregard the call. But years later, Harold Kopis, a former FBI agent who actually worked on the Joey Watkins case from season 2, started working on Freeman's case. Scott Macklem had been presented as a choir boy at trial, but Kopis learned that this picture seemed to be inaccurate.
When I start checking into Macklem, what I find out that while he's betrayed, and I know he's got a mother, and I know he probably has brothers and sisters, and a daddy, all I know, they're still alive, and that it's horrible that the man is, the young man is dead, and that's the end of that. But he wasn't a saint. And if you checked on it, you found out that he had been involved in drugs. He'd been missing classes. All the things that would tell you something was wrong. I actually interviewed a person. I don't think, but she was an older lady at the time. She's probably not around anymore. She was a librarian up there. And she said everybody knew he was into drugs. I then start lifting up a bunch of rocks, and I don't even remember now who it was, but someone had said, you know, that was a contract job coming out of Detroit. I said, what? Yeah, you know, again, I'm a skeptic. And I said, and so it turns out that, you know, I interviewed a guy who was in prison. You always have to worry about somebody who's in prison trying to tell you a story. But this guy, I put a little faith into him because regardless of what he told me, was he was in forever and a day. So this wasn't going to reduce his sentence one iota. And he said, yeah, and he laid the story out about Macklin had owed some money on drugs, hadn't paid it. They went up to collect. Things got out of hand. He got shot. Now, is that true? Don't know if it's true, but if you're going to work a case, that's another lane there to say, wait a minute, I've got another possibility of what went on.
The inmate that Copa spoke to was a man named D.C. Hill, and he implicated an alternate suspect whom we won't name in this episode. But what we can say is that he was the brother or son of the woman that the anonymous phone call was about and whom the Ford Escort was registered to. At one point, Sandra Zobida, a reporter, presented the state's key eyewitness with photos of Freeman and this alternate suspect, and her article states the following. Quote, but Gobin looked at pictures of Freeman and a man Freeman's defense team thinks did the killing. They both have dark hair and large noses. Their profiles are eerily similar. Gobin shrugged as he held them. I have no idea who he is, Gobin says, but he followed a statement. Did they say what his name is? I'd just like to know who he is. More recently, P.I. Herb Welser spoke to an attorney who, like Copas, spoke to D.C. Hill. This attorney has written an affidavit, which he has not signed, and although he was supposed to speak to Colin, he hasn't returned any phone calls. So, grain of salt and all that, but his affidavit alleges the following.
D.C. Hill met Scott Macklin in early 1985 and was soon selling drugs to him on a regular basis. He also knew the alternate suspect, a drug dealer who had a violent temper and who knew Scott Macklin closely. In the summer of 1986, a conflict arose in which Macklin thought the alternate suspect screwed him over in a drug deal. Throughout the summer, the alternate suspect and a colleague threatened, pursued, and harassed Macklin at his college and workplace. Macklin thereafter threatened to expose the alternate suspect through his political connections, including Macklin's father, who was the mayor of Croswell. D.C. Hill was asked to kill Scott Macklin, but he refused to do so. And finally, the alternate suspect then decided to kill Macklin himself by, quote, rocking Scott to sleep, i.e., making him think that everything was fine and gaining his trust so he could know Scott's whereabouts at any given time, allowing him to commit the murder on November 5th.
Again, this is unverified on our end, which is why we're not naming the alternate suspect. But it's certainly something that they'll want to explore once the statewide CIU is up and running. Meanwhile, Fred Freeman remains behind bars during a pandemic.
So on the wings alone, you have 50 prisoners on a wing, and they've got those rooms double bunked, and all of C and D wing are on lockdown also. They just brought bunks to put in our day rooms too, so we've got hundreds.
Gotcha.
So yeah, it's pretty bad. Yeah. And of course, they're used as a punitive tool. If you report that you're sick, they put you in some kind of isolation, and they take away all of your stuff. So, you know, you have a TV and a radio and things. If you're in your cell, at least you have something to do during this lockdown. If you tell them that you're feeling sick, they simply take all of your stuff.
Right.
And I said to the administration, listen, if he's contaminated, then his TV and radio or whatever are contaminated. They're not cleaning the prisoner's property. They're just taking all their property. So this has nothing to do with custody or being sick, of course. So this is to keep the prisoners from reporting that they're sick. And I had said this also, and Chris Gouts basically called me a liar about that. And sure enough, when the Detroit News article came out, other prisons around the state reported the same thing that I had said. They're using it as a punitive tool to keep us from reporting that we're sick. And then, of course, they're not doing testing on most of the prisoners anyways, and that keeps the numbers artificially low. So, like I said, we have hundreds on this compound.
Right.
And, yeah, it's really bad. So, basically, if you tell them you're sick, you get starved, you get no medical care. You know, we're not getting ventilators or hydroxychloroquine or anything like that. You get substandard portions of food, and you're just locked in a hot cell with no possessions whatsoever. It's ridiculous.
But the pandemic gives Freeman another shot at release. He has a variety of conditions that make him immunocompromised, and his team has written letters to the parole board and the governor asking for his release due to medical exigency and actual innocence. And if he gets that release, he has a lot to live for. Freeman had a first marriage in prison to a woman named Amiko, who fought to prove his innocence for years before dying from cancer. More recently, a reporter named Nolan Finley wrote a piece in 2019 about Freeman spending another Christmas behind bars, despite evidence of his innocence. And that prompted a letter.
I got a great article by Nolan Finley. He came to see me at Christmas. And usually I'm a pretty upbeat guy, but I'd been a little bummed. And but I love Christmas. Even in prison, I love Christmas. I love Christmas music and snow and trees and all that stuff. And I got a letter, and I think it was December 27th. And it was from this girl, Paula. And, again, this is a person that does not do stuff like this. You know, she's, my fiance is very square, which is fine. I love that about her. But, she wrote me and said, I got this feeling, you know, and I decided I had to write you and just see if you're okay. And do you need anything? And, do you have anybody helping you? And are you alone in there? It was really sweet. And I wrote her back and, I'm telling you, Colin, I just had this feeling. It was like the feeling I had with Amiko, you know, that this was just a really special person. And, so we wrote a couple of letters back and forth, and she told me a lot about herself. I told her about myself, and I offered some nutritional advice, and it worked out well for her. And so finally one day she said, you know, why don't you call me? And so I called her, and we just talked friendly, but it didn't take long. I started feeling something for her, and it's funny if you watch the progression, like in the letters, you can just kind of see us, you know, like slowly moving into a relationship. It's really neat. And then finally one day she says, like, you know, like when you come home, not when you get out, but when you come home. And I was, my heart kind of jumped a bit. And I said in the phone to her, I said, you know, you said when I come home, not when I get out. She said, yeah, when you come home to me. And that was it. She just made her mind up. And the thing was, I wanted that, you know. I wanted that to be the case, but I didn't want to try to push myself on her at all. And I didn't want her to think that I was, you know, trying to drag her into a relationship. But it just happened. It was amazing. And she, you know what? She came in the visiting room, and I fell head over heels in love with her, like on the spot. I mean, I was already in love with her, I guess, but it was like magic. I couldn't stop looking at her the whole visit. She's just such an incredible person, and she's so kind and so sweet and so loving. And I pray that I may get to go home to her and have a wonderful life with her. I absolutely believe that she's a person I was meant to be with for the rest of my life. And so I'm as happy as you can be in here right now.
Well, if God willing, you know, you are able to get this release, how do you see that life going?
I want the same things out of life. You know, I want a very simple life. After all these years of being locked up, you know, I could live in a motorhome for the rest of my days and be happy, obviously. And she's like me. She wants a simple life, you know. Live our faith, live in our little farmhouse, serenade her with the guitar. Just a real simple existence. We don't use drugs. We're both health nuts. We both work out. We both believe in super strict, healthy diets. So we really want all the same things out of life. We both love animals, you know, kittens and puppies. It's been amazing. I mean, it's been amazing. I'm just praying that I get to go home to her soon.
And so, 34 years after the murder of Scott Macklem, the rock and roll tomcatting 23-year-old is now a reflective man in his late 50s, just looking for a simple life. Back before COVID-19, we thought and hoped his case might be resolved by now. But now we're doing the same thing he's been doing for 3.5 decades, waiting. But we're not giving up on his case. We will keep investigating, exploring, and working with the CIU. And we hope that one day soon, Fred Freeman will get to live his simple life, freed from the prison walls.
I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can support us at our Patreon site at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And you can follow us at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.